And you can listen to us on KRCC every first Saturday at 2 p.m. We're also on Pikes Peak Library Channel Tuesday and Thursday at 7 p.m. and live at Bindu Smoke Brush every second Friday at 7:30, and here at Ivy Wild every last Sunday at 1 p.m. We want to thank Smoke Brush, KRCC, and especially our audience and our storytellers who make this all possible. Story Project is produced and created by Sharon Friedman. I'm your host, Charlie Ammon. No applause. If you have a story, we want to hear it. Okay, now we're really starting? Welcome to the Story Project and our first live program on KRCC. We're coming to you from the Ivy Wild Center. Thank you for coming and listening. Feel free to laugh, cry, applaud. This afternoon you will hear true personal stories told live without a script. We are creating community one story at a time. This is oral archaeology. We're beginning our fourth year, and you can listen to us on KRCC every Saturday at 2 p.m. KRCC the first Saturday at 2 p.m. and on Pikes Peak Library Channel Tuesday and Thursday at 7 p.m. We're live from Bindu Smoke Brush every second Friday at 7:30, and here at Ivy Wild every last Sunday at 1 p.m. We'd like to thank Smoke Brush and KRCC, and especially our audience and all the storytellers for making this all possible. Story Project is produced and created by Sharon Friedman. I'm your host, Charlie Ammon. If you have a story to tell, contact Sharon at the email address at the bottom of your flyer. That's SharonSFriedman@AOL.com. Okay, at this time, I'd like to ask you to power down all cell phones and electronic devices. Our first speaker is Marcy Langlois. She is Vice President of Mortgage Loan Originator. Let's give a big hand to Marcy.
I was born into the world with a set of circumstances that at times seemed difficult to overcome. At times it seemed like I was going to give up or give in, until the day arrived that I realized that I had a choice. And I was born in 1976 with a cleft lip and palate in a little town in Vermont in the Lake Champlain Islands on the border of Canada and New York. No one knew I was coming into the world with a cleft lip and palate because it was 1976. However, what that all entailed was that my mom had to feed me with an eyedropper about every 20 to 40 minutes until I started to have surgeries to repair that. I had 9 major surgeries, which consisted of about 25 procedures overall, and they would look like a team of doctors would come in and they would all operate on me doing different events all in one surgery. At one time I had my jaws broke, reset, wired shut, plates and screws put in my face, tubes taken out of my ears, and all my wisdom teeth pulled, bone taken out of my hip and put in my jaw. That was one surgery. So it was ongoing and it was interesting. And that started, I had my first surgery when I was 3 months old and my last when I was 17. Along with a cleft lip and palate comes a whole bunch of other things, ear infections, sinus infections, and lots of different abnormalities. However, I was very blessed in the fact that I only had sinus infections and ear infections. Along with that, I'm really nervous, I'm sorry, I don't look anything like I used to look. And my nose was pretty flat to my face. I had an 11 millimeter underbite. I had 3 front teeth. I spoke much different, and I required speech lessons. So that was the beginning of my life, just to kind of give you an idea of where things kind of started. And I'm so grateful for my mom. She was my rock through all of this. My dad drank a lot when I was a little girl until I was 15 years old, and he quit drinking. But our life was pretty volatile with my dad. Things didn't come easily. We didn't have a lot of money. We lived in a trailer in the middle of a field with no running water while my parents were trying to make enough money to build a well house. So things were always interesting, to say the least, in our home. And I went to school when I was 5, and I had grown up in this small community that completely supported me, knew what I looked like, knew how I spoke, never treated me any differently because of it. And then I went to this school where nobody knew who I was or what I looked like, because I went to this Catholic school in the state of New York. So all these kids, I show up, and all these kids are looking at me and pointing at me and thinking that I'm different, which I was. And they taunted and teased me and bullied me and name-called me. And my mom and dad came to the school and got involved quickly, and the kids in my class stopped doing that, but the kids above me and the kids below me didn't. But at least within my own grade, I felt safe. So school went on like that, and as I'm going to school, I know that there's something else going on, and I recognize that I am attracted to little girls instead of little boys. So I'm sitting in this Catholic school in another state with an 11-millimeter underbite, with my nose pretty flat to my face, and I'm thinking, I like little girls. This is great. Really? You got to be kidding me, right? So that made it really interesting. And, you know, I was so afraid, and I prayed to God that he would take this away from me and that my life would look different and that I would like boys at some point and things would just be different for me. That didn't happen. So anyway, school continued to be interesting, but I really strived and excelled at school. I really loved it, and I was naturally smart. And what I learned quickly was if I could be a perfectionist at things, then people would not pay attention to what I looked like. They would pay attention to what I did. And that would take the focus off my physical body and put it more on my actions. So I was the fastest, the smartest, the best reader, the whatever, right? Whatever contest you were having, I was going to be the best at. So, and I learned that as a defense mechanism, and it worked great for a lot of years until that didn't work out so well anymore for me. So, moving along through school, it was always interesting. I got out of Catholic school, and then I went to regular public school, which was kind of like, I don't really know how to describe it. It was kind of like going to the zoo, though, for me. You know, I was in this very structured environment, and then all of a sudden I'm in this public school where you can do anything you want to whenever you want to. Well, it seemed that way to me. And so I adopted that as my philosophy. And so I went through middle school and on to high school and still struggling, you know, struggling with my sexuality, struggling with, you know, what the way I looked, and were people going to accept me or were they not, or how is that all going to be? How is it all going to work out? And it was this constant game of really not liking myself, but trying to like myself and trying to be grateful that my circumstances weren't as bad as others. And, you know, trying to do all of this stuff, but really inside always having this battle of self-hatred and never being good enough. No matter what I did, I never felt good enough. So throughout all of that, I went to high school, got into high school, started drinking a bit when I was in middle school, and found that that was my elixir, right? That was my safe haven. It allowed me to focus on something different, and it allowed me to not care about what other people thought about me, whether or not they looked at me or they didn't. And I thought, okay, well, here we go. Finally, something is going my way. And I carried that on into high school, and I started drinking in high school more rapidly, more repetitively, on a more regular basis. And my freshman year in high school, three of our friends, ours, mine and my brother's friends, were killed within 19 days of each other in a car accident, and that was December. And once that happened, that really changed who I was as a person. And my grades started slipping, I stopped playing sports, and I really started drinking and drugging. And high school you know, overall high school was okay. I partied a lot, and that's really what I did mainly. And then I maintained doing well in school, and I kept getting good grades, and, you know, but it wasn't as good as it should have been or could have been. But what ended up happening is my last surgery came my junior year in high school, and things were really starting to look up for me. And so I figured I'm going to get my act together, and I'm going to apply at some colleges, and I'm really going to get stuff going. And, you know, I'm going to get out of this little town, and I'm going to go and look for opportunity other places. And so I did that. I kind of got my act together a bit and started going to a few more classes than I normally did, and started applying for colleges, and everything was moving along nicely. And then my senior year comes, and we're halfway through senior year, and everything's going fine, and I've got everything out for colleges, and it's January 31st of 1994, and I had an after-school job, and I was on my way to my after-school job, and I pulled in the parking lot. And as I pulled in the parking lot, there was a song that I loved on the radio, and so I decided to pull back out of the parking lot and drive through this little town, which is about two city blocks, right, my hometown. So I drive down one end of town, turn around at the Legion parking lot, come back out, and I'm on my way to work. And this car pulls out in front of me, and I can't stop. And I try everything I can to stop, and I cannot stop, and I hit that car. And all three people in the car were killed. And my life changed forever at that moment. And so what happened after that was, I'm not still even really clear today, right? I can just tell you what I think happened. But what I think happened after that was that I sentenced myself to a life of self-hate and judgment. I woke up every day and believed that I killed these three people, and didn't believe that I deserved anything good because of what I had done. And so I really started drinking and drugging at that time, and trying to figure out what to do next. I got accepted at college, and I left, and I went to college, and I couldn't function. And I went to college, and I never attended a class. I was there for 6 weeks, and all I did was drink and drug. And I called my mom, and I said, "Mom, you got to come and get me, or I'm going to kill myself. Like, I can't be here. I can't fit in. I can't do anything. I can't function." So my mom came and got me, and I went back to our hometown. And then I decided I'm going to leave. I got to get out of here, right? Everybody knows what has happened. I have to drive by the scene of the accident every day. It's right across the street from my grandparents' diner. I can't escape it. So I moved to Florida, and so this little, right, me, farm girl in the middle of Central Florida, right, I had never seen Hispanic people in my life, truly, and I thought tacos were, you know, out of the box. So, I mean, seriously, you want to talk about culture shock, it was unbelievable, right? But I got to Florida, and I found people just like me, people who were hurting and wounded and acting out of that place. And they were drinking and drugging, so I thought they were my best friends, and it was perfect. And I did that for a while in Florida. Excuse me. And then that didn't work. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try to escape myself somewhere else. I'm going to move to Colorado. So I did. I came to Colorado. I was actually on my way to Alaska and stopped here, and I haven't left since. But, you know, I got derailed a bit. So I came to Colorado, and I did the same thing again, right? Because wherever I go, there I am. And I had no idea how true that statement really is. And what ended up happening is I found the same people, and I did the same things here. And then, just checking my time. And then all of a sudden, things changed for me. I met this woman named Tracy, who is my wife today, and we've been together for 13 years. And she had a daughter named Brianna, and she is 21 today and here. And I thought, okay, I got to do something here. This is a big opportunity, I think. And so I was driving down the road one day, and I had been drinking, and Brianna was sitting in the front seat with me, and she was talking away, and I'm not really paying attention because I'm drinking, and, you know, just really disconnected. And all of a sudden, I got this thought. I am doing exactly the same thing to her that my father did to me, not showing up. And like any good alcoholic, I went straight to the bar and kept drinking more. And then, but about 10 days later, something changed for me. And I went to my first 12-step meeting, and I have not had a drink or a drug since March 25th of 2003. Thank you. And that's when my life changed. That's when my life really started changing, and I went through a whole bunch of stuff trying to get sober and staying sober and staying clean and sober. And what ended up happening, though, is I started working with a therapist who understood what PTSD was and trauma and how to work with all of this stuff. And she recommended that I go to the Meadows, a level one psychiatric facility in Wickenburg, Arizona. And I went there twice, and I did tons and tons of work around the car accident in my life, trauma. And what ended up happening was amazing, is that I came back from the Meadows, and I got off the plane, and my wife was there. And I said, I know that I didn't kill those three people. So it was profound, to say the least. And I got a new lease on life. And I started to learn how to love myself. And I learned how to develop compassion for myself. And I learned that my life is not what happens to me, but it is... My life is not what happens to me. Those are just experiences. I am Marcy. This is me, right? Those are things that happen to me. And I don't have to carry that with me for the rest of my life. I get to go on. I get to keep living. I get to have a sense of freedom and peace today that I never thought would be possible. Thank you so much for listening.
Let's have another hand for Marcy. And Marcy's wife, Tracy, is in the audience. Would you stand up, Tracy? Let's hear it for Tracy. Thank you. Our next storyteller is Karen Stone. She is an equestrian. Please give a big hand to Karen.
Was standing over my dead horse in the middle of a field in the rain in Colorado. Of course it would rain that day. It was October of 2012, and I thought to myself, well, it could be worse, it could be snowing. One of those times where I thought, this is what you have a husband for, so you don't have to deal with a dead animal. I don't really want to deal with this. I'd gotten the call from Aaron, who worked for me at the ranch, and all he could say was, I think Templeton's dead. And I couldn't think of what to do next. Templeton was a pretty good little thoroughbred horse, quite small for a big jumper, but he made up for that with bravado. He thought he was pretty darn cool. He'd lived to a ripe 25 years, and that was pretty good considering he'd had a full race career before he turned into a jumping horse. So I got into my car to drive the 45 minutes there, and I thought, well, I'll call my vet. So I called my vet, and she said that she would go over and check on him and number one, make sure he was indeed dead, and also see whether or not she could tell what had happened to him. Then I called my husband. Both Dodd and I wished that he could be there to help in this situation, but he'd been sick for a few years already, and he just couldn't be. But he helped me figure out what to do next. He convinced me that we should bury him in that field where he actually was lying at the time, a piece of land attached to the ranch in Black Forest that we had just sold. So my next phone call was to my builder to try to get excavator's numbers, because then I'm trying to figure out how we can get him buried that day, because you just don't want a carcass sitting out overnight. You just don't know what's going to happen. So I got three numbers, called all three. Nobody answered, had to leave messages. My vet called me back. She said, it just looks like Templeton had a heart attack out in the field. One more name came to me. It was a company that we had used quite a bit when we first moved out to the ranch. I called them. Sure enough, they could come out that afternoon. So there it was, that afternoon. John Munson met me out there, and luckily his front-end loader could fit through that back gate. Aaron came with me to the backfield, and we picked out a spot for Templeton's final resting place. Aaron had had a pretty long day, a pretty emotional day, so as John went down to start digging the hole, Aaron went and took the tarp off of Templeton's body and went to take it back to the barn. So there I was alone, and his body was no longer relaxed. I mean, seriously, it's a little like National Lampoon's Animal House, like completely stiff-legged. And the rain is coming down, and it occurs to me that I haven't brought a pair of scissors to cut off a piece of mane and tail. It's customary to keep a piece of mane and tail on the horses you get to say goodbye to. I'd had horses euthanized in the past, but the vet had always done that for me. So I reached into my pocket, and I pulled out my little buck knife. It's always dull because I use it for everything. And I started sawing a piece of his mane. And I thought to myself, wow, Karen, you have come a long way. I was born in New York City, a complete urbanite. I was born into a cosmopolitan lifestyle. My parents hosted parties with artists, musicians, scholars. I grew up surviving the perils of divorce, the death of my father at the age of 7, the trials of living life with an aggressive stepfather and an unconfident mother. I found horses at an early age, and horses were my savior. Oh, to ride horses, that's all I wanted to work for, all the goals I wanted to set. There's something about sitting atop an animal that at any given moment could choose to run for its life, where time stands still. Nothing else matters. You have to be present. And horses don't lie. They only do for a rider because of a language between that horse and rider. And they wait for that communication. This is nothing like the humans that up until this point in my life had proven pretty unreliable. So these are show jumping horses I'm talking about, and big show jumping barns back east, and I just dove right into that environment. I was driven to excel and compete. I think I achieved every goal I set, but with a lot of scarring along the way. I trained with the man that wrote the book on hunt seat equitation, literally, and it's still the book that's used as the resource today. A completely militaristic training environment. All the education forced. I like to say that I was lucky to get out of that environment without an eating disorder or a drug habit. But I was a pretty proven soldier up to that point, a pretty good soldier, a survivor. When my junior career was done, I quit. I was so burned out. So I fumbled my way through a Yale education. Without those militaristic boundaries, I was, it was a bit of a free-for-all for a while. But I came out the other side with a strange sense of self. You graduate from an Ivy League school, and you have expectations on you that are much greater than others your age, or at least that's what I thought at the time. It wasn't until a friend of mine had me help her drive her car from Long Island to Boulder that I truly started to feel free and independent. There's something about Colorado. There's a certain flow to it. Everything seemed easier here. Don't get me wrong, I did not give up my urban ways. I lived in Lodo before it was called Lodo. I worked as an assistant to the curator of the American Art Department at the Denver Art Museum using my Yale degree. But you could shed your work clothes on Friday and don a sweatshirt for the weekend, and nobody judges you for that. Everybody tries to relax here. So it was only here that I felt comfortable enough to seek out the company of equines again. I didn't want to put away that chapter of my life on such a negative note. Horses were my savior. So I get New York City to Lodo and New York to Colorado, but urban to ranch in the rain? You know, the transformation seems totally normal when you're living it. I always thought I'd live this sophisticated lifestyle of my parents and have artists and musicians part of my social circle, but somehow the ranch life with Dodd seemed part of the Colorado flow. Dodd grew up here in the Springs, Wood Avenue. His life looked pretty good on paper, too. Luckily, he found horses as well. They were his savior. Convinced he would have had a continued life of substance abuse if he hadn't made that connection. He became a farrier at an early age. Not only a manly vocation, molding and shaping steel, a horseshoer is part of a performance horse's wellness team. He could actually help horses with his craft. And boy, was he handsome. The ranch guy that could pull off wearing a purple polo shirt. The epitome of strong in my book. We met as farrier client. I was still living in Lodo. I had this totally spiky do. Something about my character attracted him. So fast forward a few years. We just get married. We're buying an 86-acre ranch in the Black Forest. Oh yeah, and we're going into business together. So research the top stressors in people's lives, and I've just named three. But we're going to do the worst thing, and we're going to do it right. We're going to have this ranch. We're going to do it our way. Thank goodness I had inheritance money. That's all I have to say. And thank goodness we were two of the most hammerheaded people I've ever met. Nothing was good enough for me. Everything was frustrated. Like a good urbanite, I couldn't understand why everything couldn't be perfect right away. I wanted this perfect setting. Amazing horses for my own competition goals, clients that only wanted me and my help, and of course a husband that woke every day so grateful that he'd married such a wonderful, dynamic woman, even though I did nothing but complain all the time about how things weren't perfect. Nothing was good enough for me. And then there was my husband. Nothing was good enough for him. Oh my goodness. Oh, you know what would break loose if the hose wasn't drained and coiled just perfectly. He was so anal. Every detail mattered to him in his mechanical mind. I just wanted to skip all those details and get to the end result. And it didn't occur to me that I was giving up a sophisticated lifestyle. We still traveled. I still had my Yale friends on the phone. And I would go off competing with wealthy, educated people. But there's something about horse show people. They live a warped sense of reality, and I'm not really convinced that most would know what to do if all the water buckets froze. I had this sense of this collision of these two lives of mine the day after my biggest Grand Prix win the $50,000 Grand Prix of Denver. I was on barn duty at my house, and there I am, cleaning out the trailer and turning horses out. And, you know, the day before, I'd been handed champagne and signing autographs and being interviewed. So all of a sudden, it felt awkward. Did I choose the ranch life over the sophisticated life? Do I have to choose? I smile now when I think of the perspective that gave me. As the distance age presents often does, I look back and savor those times. What we got to do together, the horses I got to ride, and all in this peaceful environment, so full of rawness. There were storms out there so severe, I could understand how pioneers would lose their lives 20 feet from their doorsteps. Days where a game of Yahtzee was all we could add to the agenda, because feeding horses meant suiting up in our Carhartts, digging out our ski goggles, and strapping on snowshoes just to make the short trek from the house to the barn. We ran a boarding and training facility out there, and it's a 24/7 job. And the ranch didn't pay for itself, because horses don't pay for themselves. And it's a lifestyle. Just when you think everything's going fine, the tractor breaks, or there's some other time-consuming, expensive hurdle. We put 17 years into that ranch and into our marriage, and we had to sell it in order to survive. All of our heart and soul had gone into its flourishing, and we had to let it go in order to live. You see, as I stood over my dead horse, my first Grand Prix horse, the horse I'd had the longest, the horse that arrived into my life the day of Dodds and my engagement party, I was speaking to my husband at the other end of a phone line at an assisted living facility. The strongest man I'd ever known was crippled by Parkinson's and spinal cord damage due to a teenage injury. So as I sawed off that piece of mane, I thought, wow, you've truly graduated. You can do this. Be emotional about the happenings and practical about what needs to happen. Alone. And I'm so grateful to that horse and his timing, so that I could feel those feelings and be present in what was such a culminating moment. Because what I didn't know was that I was to say goodbye to my husband 4 days after that. Dodd had become the man that woke every day grateful that I loved him. He was appreciative, warm, humble, all the things I'd ever wanted from him. And his greatest gift was to let me go. Now it's my choice which life I choose to live. You never think you're ready. But Templeton taught me I was ready. I stand before you, a 48-year-old, New York City-born, Colorado ranch woman who can saw a piece of mane off her dead horse in the middle of a field in the rain, and I'm so grateful.
Let's hear it one more time for Karen. Come on. Okay, our final speaker of the afternoon is Mickey Wendt, who is a soldier. And let's hear it for Mickey.
The toughest person that you can think of? What makes them so tough? Mental toughness? Physical toughness? Or both? I'd driven past that place countless of times. I'd look off to the left, I'd see that scar. It looked like it was going to disappear into the sky. I said to myself, one day I'm going to learn its secrets. This scar is known as the Manitou Incline. Better known as the incline to the locals. Manitou Incline sits at the base of Pike's Peak. 2,200 base expanse, 2,000 foot rise, 68% increase in grade in some locations. Tops out at a little bit over 1 mile. The incline is an old cog railway that was built to provide gravity-fed water to the town of Manitou Springs in Colorado. Once the hydroelectric water plant was built, the railway was turned into an attraction, tourist attraction. And people were able to ride this until 1990, when a devastating rock slide forced the closure of the attraction, leaving only the railroad ties behind to grow back into nature. It has since become a popular fitness grounds for hikers and runners alike. I wanted to pay tribute to this incline. It was an early January morning when I started out. I wanted to be able to see the sunrise, so I started out about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was cold. I was able to see my breath, and I put layers on because I didn't want to be cold as I walked up this incline. And as I started out, I saw a husband and wife team standing off to the side, arguing with each other, trying to decide if they wanted to go up. They were pointing, and they were arguing, and they were pointing backwards. I'm not sure what they were saying, but I'm sure one of them wanted to go and one of them didn't. I decided to walk past them. First few hundred feet, no big deal, but I was starting to heat up, so I took off my hat, walked a few more feet, took off my gloves. It didn't seem near as cold as it did before, so I started taking off my jacket. Kept walking, and I could feel the altitude start to get to me. It was a little bit more work to get up to the top. Took off my second jacket. And then there was a dog and a gentleman that passed me. And the dog kept turning around and looking at me. Take two more steps, turn around and look at me again. And again, two more steps until the owner tugged on him. And you know what that dog did? Turned around and looked at me again. And it was as if the dog was saying, I understand what you're going through. I have to do it too. But you don't look so good. So I'm off to the side, panting, trying to catch my breath, take off my third jacket. And I knew then, at that point, I had to dig deep within myself. Deep down, so deep, that I had to pull out my prayer beads. And I started praying. Our Father, I think I started that prayer four or five times before I could move on to the next bead. I couldn't remember the words to that prayer. I couldn't remember how it went. I think the altitude, the thinness of the air was starting to get to me. I like to think that I'm in pretty good shape. I'm young, and I'm strong, and I'm healthy. It was kind of weird. I looked left, and I saw these two grandmas. They were carrying on a conversation about their grandchildren as they passed me. And then I looked right. There was an old man with a gray beard and a walking stick. I think he was twice my age. And he was already on his third trip up that morning. You want to know how many people I passed? I passed. Yes, I remember. I passed exactly zero people. I passed zero people along the way. But I was getting closer to that 68% grade increase. I was crawling up it on my hands. But there's a point where you can leave the trail if you feel you can't accomplish it. And I saw two gentlemen off to the left. And I stopped and talked to them as an excuse to catch my breath. And in the course of this conversation, they said that they were with another group and they were thinking about leaving the trail. I said, I don't think that's such a good idea. I said, because for one, the entire group has already made it to the top and they know you never made it. Two, you're going to feel great about yourself if you continue on. You're going to regret the fact that you left if you leave it. And three, we're almost there. I can see the top. So the three of us decided to head towards that top. And of course, they managed to walk and pass me. And as I was climbing to the top, I was so excited. I was getting a little bit more energy. And I got to the top, and then I realized I wasn't at the top. It's what's known as the false summit. I still had a quarter mile left before I reached the actual top. But I continued on. I knew I had to, because I was thinking about those two grandmas and that old man that passed me. And I was walking, losing my breath, on the brink of losing my lungs, and then all of a sudden I heard it. I heard the cheering and the clapping. You can do it, you're almost at the top, come on, just a little bit more, you're almost there. I was feeling good about myself. This crowd of strangers that I don't know lined up across the top, cheering for me. This is awesome. I could hear them cheering me on. You can do it. You're almost there. You can do it, Martha. You can do it. Wait a minute. My name's not Martha. I look behind me. There's Martha. I didn't want Martha to pass me. So I took everything that was left in me. I'm like, I don't care. They're cheering. Even if it's not for me, I'm going to take it. When I reached the top, I heard the Rocky theme go through my head once he walked up to the top of those stairs. I knew it. For me to accomplish the incline, I had to find that inner strength that was inside of me. I had to be able to make that mind and body connection to constantly validate the belief in myself that I could really do it. It was then that I knew that I'd accomplished something that I could really be proud of. I conquered the Manitou Incline. Yes! People don't climb the incline because it's easy. They climb it because it makes them tougher. Now, as I drive past that scar, I can look off to the left, shake my finger, and say, I know your secrets, and I have conquered you.
Thank you, Mickey. Big hand for Mickey. All right. Okay, let's have all the storytellers back for one last time. And back in the back there is our producer, the lovely Sharon Friedman. Let's hear a hand for Sharon. Let's get all the storytellers back out here for one last bow. Wonderful afternoon, folks. You've been a great audience. We want to thank you for coming out. And remember, we want to hear your stories. Just email Sharon on that email at the bottom of your flyer. So have a wonderful evening. Thank you for coming, and drive home safe.